Traveling from Australia to Los Angeles to New York, Rabbi Goren found the flight going back to Israel Saturday night from the Long Island airport. And so he spent Shabbat in what is, then is now, a well-known Long Island Jewish community, a community that includes a synagogue that was known and is known as the White Shul because of the marble exterior that it had sported. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 225, From the White House to the White Shul. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. It is a ritual described in Deuteronomy. Prior to battle, an anointed priest or kohen addresses the troops, inspiring them to look to divine assistance and to draw strength and courage therefrom. The kohen would solemnly declaim, "Let not your hearts faint, fear not and do not tremble, nor be terrified because of them. For the Lord your God is he that goes with you to fight for you against your enemies, to save you." In the Second Temple period, this military and religious role seems to have been filled by Judah the Maccabee, who reminded his troops again and again prior to battle that God would be the source of victory against the seemingly superior forces of the Seleucids. It was taken as the greatest vindication of Judah's promise that his troops soon after captured Jerusalem, restoring it to the faithful of the Jewish people. And in 1967, with war looming and many focusing on Egypt, one religious and military figure was certain that Providence had ordained this crisis for more than a battle with Nasser's troops, and that with faith and courage, the time had come for ancient Jerusalem to be restored to the Jewish people. During the period in Israel known as Hahamtana, the period of waiting, a consensus built in Eshkol's cabinet for a military strike. Meanwhile, the prospect of the annihilation of the Jewish state had brought the feuding Arab states together in a profound unity. Not only Jordan, which had expressly allied itself with Nasser, but also the other countries of the larger Middle East. Michael Oren writes, quote, "In spite of the bitter differences between them, the divisions of opinion in each, Arab nations were united as at no time in their post-colonial history," end quote. And Oren goes on to give examples. Quote, "Algerian Prime Minister Houari Boumedien boasted, 'The freedom of the homeland will be completed by the destruction of the Zionist entity and the expulsion of the Americans and the British from the region.' Yemen's Foreign Minister Salam agreed, 'We want war. War is the only way to settle the problem of Israel. The Arabs are ready.'" And Oren adds, "Converging on Sinai were military contingents from countries that only days before had regarded Egypt as a mortal enemy, from Morocco and Libya, Saudi Arabia and Tunisia. Even the Syrians finally relented and agreed to send a brigade to fight alongside the Iraqis in Jordan. Combined, the Arab armies could field 900 combat aircraft, over 5,000 tanks, and 500,000 men. Added to this was immense political might. Arab oil producers had agreed to boycott any countries that assisted Israel, to nationalize their refineries and even destroy their pipelines." And Oren further cites the statement of Iraqi President Aref, who said, "Our goal is clear, to wipe Israel off the face of the map. We shall, God willing, meet in Tel Aviv and Haifa," end quote. Meanwhile, the White House had made clear its policy to Israel that while it would not participate in attempts to open the Straits of Tehran through the sending of a convoy into it or through other means, America did support Israel in this crisis and recognized that it would take action. And indeed, as Oren reports, President Johnson was convinced that Israel would triumph quickly and was already preparing, in stark contrast to Eisenhower's reaction in 1956, to support Israel in the aftermath of the war. Michael Oren further tells us that Johnson, with his advisor Walt Rostow, was confident in the imminence of a quick Israeli triumph. Quote, "Israel," Johnson believed, "would move in 2 to 3 days and complete the war in 10 at the very most. While the U.S. might back Israel diplomatically, there would be no collusion such as that between Israel and the Anglo-French expedition in Suez, no major military aid for the Jewish state. Rather, as Walt Rostow phrased it, Israel would move like a sheriff in high noon, alone, employing the force necessary to achieve not merely self-respect, but respect in the region." Johnson had already recommended that his staff start thinking of the post-war settlement. End quote. The confidence in the White House notwithstanding, a feeling of tremendous tension and worry had descended on many in Israel and the entire Jewish world. But there was one member of the IDF, among others, who was supremely confident in what would unfold. This was the chief rabbi of the IDF, Rabbi Shlomo Goren, who was speaking to the Jewish community in Australia on behalf of the UJA when word came of the closing of the Straits of Tehran. Rabbi Goren writes in his memoir, quote, "From that moment on, I told my audience at the UJA gatherings I attended that this was an emergency campaign in preparation for a war, Israel's ambassador to Australia objected to my remarks and told me there was not going to be another war, but I was convinced that a war was imminent. As the days passed, the situation in Israel worsened. I phoned Chief of Staff Yitzhak Rabin and asked him if I should cut short my trip and come home, and whether the situation was dire. "Decide for yourself," he told me. I decided to return to Israel. It was no longer possible to return via the route I had come, changing planes in Tehran, because flights to Israel from there had been discontinued. The only way that seemed reasonable to me was via Los Angeles and New York. When our hosts learned that we were leaving, a huge farewell event was arranged at an amphitheater. Many thousands attended that gathering, and many tears were shed. Members of the Jewish community in Australia knew that I was on my way back to a war situation, and no one knew what the outcome would be. There was also tremendous concern for the welfare of the soldiers. I remember saying at that gathering, with complete confidence, that even before Shavuot, with God's help, I would merit to pray at the Kotel, something that I had been prevented from doing for 19 years. "We will yet be blessed with the privilege of liberating Jerusalem and returning to our holy places," I told the assembled. "I will yet have the privilege of praying both at the Kotel and on Mount Sinai." That's how I felt during those tense days. My words were even quoted widely in the local press, end quote. This, needless to say, is not what many were predicting. Oren informs us that as preparations for war were being made in Israel, Moshe Dayan had thought that the focus would be almost entirely on Egypt and the Sinai, ordering General Uzi Narkis that, quote, "you must not do anything to entangle Israel with the Jordanians," end quote. When Narkis asked what to do in case of a Jordanian attack, Dayan replied, "In that case, bite your lip and hold the line. Within a week, we'll get to the canal and to Sharm el-Sheikh. Then the whole IDF will come here and get you out of trouble." Traveling from Australia to Los Angeles to New York, Rabbi Goren found the flight going back to Israel Saturday night from the Long Island airport. And so he spent Shabbat in what is, then as now, a well-known Long Island Jewish community, a community that includes a synagogue that was known and is known as the White Shul because of the marble exterior that it had sported. Rabbi Goren describes the flight to Israel after Shabbat and the Sabbath that preceded it. Quote, "The situation was very tense to the point that the plane took off almost empty, but full of equipment and weapons for the war effort. During that Shabbat, while we were waiting in New York, we were hosted by the Jewish community of Long Island. When I went to the large synagogue there called the White Shul, many people noticed me and wondered what I was doing there. I explained that I was on my way home from a trip to Australia. The following morning, thousands of Jews came to the synagogue and I was asked to speak to them. There was great excitement and some people were happy and crying at the same time. There was such an emotional outburst. I spent the entire Shabbat going from one synagogue to another, addressing standing room only crowds of thousands. I told them all what I had said in Australia, that they shouldn't be afraid and should not cry. With God's help, we were going to liberate Jerusalem. Soon, I would be davening at the Kotel." End quote. This then, ladies and gentlemen, was how a large New York Jewish community spent the Shabbat before the Six-Day War, with a spiritual and military figure promising divinely ordained victory. Upon arriving back in Israel, Rabbi Goren composed several prayers for the IDF. To those flying in the Air Force, he cited a verse from Lamentations, "Pursue them in anger and destroy them from under the heavens of the Lord." And to the larger IDF, he cited the age-old exhortation of Deuteronomy. His prayer included this passage, quote, "Soldiers of the Israel Defense Forces on land, on sea, and in the air, may God be with you, courageous soldiers. Hear, O Israel, you draw near today to do battle against your enemies. The great day for the Jewish people is upon us, and your steps today toward the great and decisive campaign for the salvation of Israel from its enemies who have risen up against Israel to eradicate us and destroy us. The eyes of all Israel are raised to you, dear soldiers. Let not your hearts faint. Fear not and do not tremble, nor be terrified because of them. For the Lord your God is he that goes with you to fight for you against your enemies to save you." End quote. Thus did the chief rabbi say the age-old prayer preceding a war in which so many were focused on Egypt, but a war in which the rabbi was thinking, above all, of Jerusalem. And indeed, there is a connection, of course, between the concept of Jerusalem and faith in battle. For the Jewish sages, the name Yerushalayim is a combination of Shalem, the original city that had been conquered by David, and Yirah, which means awe, reverence, a word that refers not to the Jebusite city, but rather to the place higher up on Mount Moriah, where Abraham bound his son, and where the temple was built. If David, after capturing the city of Jerusalem, known originally as Shalem, focused beyond the city to Yirah, to Mount Moriah, it was because, though the capture of his capital embodied his military success, he wished to remind Israel that his victories in battle were due to the divine sustainer of Israel who had addressed Abraham on Mount Moriah so many centuries before, and would be atop Mount Moriah in 1967, that the providence of God in battle would reveal itself once again. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.